Hello and welcome to Money Talks, our new series from Slate Money. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. We are here to have conversations with awesome, amazing, brilliant people. And this week, I'm here with Marissa Meltzer. Marissa, introduce yourself.
My name is Marissa Meltzer. I wrote a book called Glossy, which is about the brand Glossier, the beauty industry, girl bosses. And I'm a journalist. I write a lot for the New York Times and some other places.
We are here. We're going to talk about money in the beauty industry, beauty in the money industry. We're going to talk about the weird creature that is the executive chair role. We're going to talk a lot about Emily Weiss, who's the founder of Glossier. We're going to talk about why Paris is so attractive and romantic. We're going to talk about Marissa's own favorite place to buy cosmetics. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Okay, so you have written a book about the beauty industry in general. And now help me pronounce this company's name.
Glossier.
Glossier.
Yeah, it's a little bit fake French.
It sounds very French to me. Is it actually a word? That's not a word in French, right?
No. Although when they launched in Paris, they had an ad campaign that was Liberté, Égalité, Glossier.
I'm deeply suspicious already. But anyway, so you've written about Glossier in the long tradition of beauty companies that sound European because it sounds more glamorous or something. Mm-hmm. Although it started as a blog called Into the Gloss.
Yeah. So when Glossier came out of Into the Gloss, I assumed it was pronounced glossier. It was more glossy than Into the Gloss or something. Yeah. But no, it was, I don't know. It was apparently a play on the word dossier, which also makes no sense. But just makes you think of, like, I don't know, someone surveilling you, which is maybe apt, but not what you want.
So right now, to fast forward to the end, Glossier is yet another beauty brand that you can buy at Sephora and has a vaguely French sounding name and sells product to people who want to put product on their faces. And it kind of competes in that space with a long list of other beauty brands that, you know, are familiar or less familiar, depending on how much you care about such stuff. It's been around for about a decade or so, and it has found itself a little niche in the market where it seems to be doing perfectly okay. If that was just the story, I feel like that wouldn't really be a book.
No, it wouldn't. And I would say that they aren't just a brand. They are kind of like the millennial brand of all millennial brands. The story of Glossier is the story of the last decade or so in culture and in business and in feminism and all the other things that we're wrestling with. And that's what the book's about.
And that's what the book's about. So one of the big questions that I wanted to ask you is, like, is it still true that it's like the millennial brand now that the millennials are all like homeowners with families and, you know, turning 40 and all the rest of it? Like, mm-hmm. Is Glossier like the beauty brand for the 40-year-old mom?
I would say they are still the millennial beauty brand, maybe more towards the younger millennial demographic. And they also are really big with Gen Z and do really well on TikTok. So it seems like Glossier has staying power. But I guess Glossier, one of the reasons why they became famous was that they were a beauty line for people. Like, do you know Proactiv, that acne line that advertises on TV a lot?
as someone who never watches TV and never buys product, I'm not the right person
anyway,
to ask this question.
There are many people know what Proactiv is. It's like it started out with infomercials and it was very big with teenagers. It's acne focused. So it's like once you've graduated away from just wanting to clear up your acne and before you were maybe in your late 30s and 40s and you want to maybe spend real money on trying to figure out what's going on with like your eye bags or, you know, whatever happens. There was this middle ground and Glossier figured out that, you know, they were sort of going to be like Clinique for a younger generation.
Is Clinique French?
Of course not.
Because it sounds French.
Well, the woman, one of the founders of Clinique's, I think, wife or one of the consultants saw signs in Paris for Clinique Esthétique. And said, oh, we should call, they were calling it like some sort of, you know, like working title brand of like, it was going to be sort of the junior version of Estee Lauder. And so in the late 60s, Clinique gave it that French shine and also that sort of idea of a little bit of science.
Because French is glamorous, right? That's like, that's the great American conception of Paris is that it's incredibly like glamorous.
That's what my next book is about. I'm leaving for Paris on on Thursday, so I'll let you know. But yeah.
Your next book is about like what is it about Paris that Americans find so attractive?
So that's like the sort of background of the book. The book is about Jane Birkin, the actress and singer.
Another person who isn't French,
exactly. Although a lot of Americans are shocked that she isn't French, which is interesting to me.
Great French brands are not French. Jane Birkin, Clinique, exactly. Glossier.
Yeah. That's my niche.
That's
fake
your
French.
Niche. Fake French.
Yeah.
All right. So we have Glossier. It's a blog. It has a bunch of millennial readers. It then pivots into product and it becomes part of the beauty industry. And along the way, it does that thing that hundreds of companies did over the past 10, 20 years or so, which is it became a unicorn. And the minute you become a unicorn and your CEO/founder is a woman, then you suddenly become a girl boss. And this is like the big theme of your book is like, what is the girl boss? And does Emily Weiss in particular encapsulate girl bossitude or is she sort of off to one edge and kind of different from the rest of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of lesser girl bosses whose companies were valued at way less than $1 billion that still proudly, you know, I mean, is that a Lingua Franca shirt that you're wearing?
I am wearing a Lingua Franca shirt.
I mean, girl boss adjacent.
Okay.
I profiled the founder, Rochelle, for New York Magazine once upon a time. You know, she was very in the mix. So, look, everywhere you go, there's a girl boss. But yeah, I mean, on a more serious note, I think in that era, so we're talking about maybe 5-10 years ago, there was this feeling that there were these younger female entrepreneurs that had consumer-facing kind of companies and they were fashionable and kind of glamorous and conventionally attractive. They lived in, you know, New York or LA, and they were the girl bosses. And whether or not they liked that title or...
One of them actually wrote a book called Girl Boss.
Well, yes. So there's this woman, Sofia Amoroso, who founded this company called Nasty Gal, which was just like an online clothing company. And her sort of self-help come business guy come memoir was called Hashtag Girl Boss. So she really took, you know, the title to the bank and everyone else had to kind of deal with being in trend stories where they were called girl bosses. And, you know, it's a little bit offensive. It's a diminutive. Like there is no boy boss, although now all the tech founders are kind of acting like boy bosses.
I feel like SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried was a boy
boss. He's a boy boss. I would argue Elon Musk is a bit of a boy boss these
100%.
Days.
100%. Yeah. And so... You decide to write this book about Emily Weiss and her company Glossier. And one of the things you discover as you write this book is that this woman who broke onto the scene as a blogger, and as a blogger myself, I can totally identify with this. And the thing that you do to have a successful blog is to have a very clear and recognizable voice. And she came out and she was very honest and open. And then suddenly... She is a girl boss and entrepreneur, and she has like a cap table and a bunch of VC investors. And you try and ask her questions like, so what do you feel about this label and various other questions? And at some point, she just stops being human and just starts becoming this sort of like robotic, like business speak person.
Yeah, she's a cipher. I mean, that was part of why I wanted to write a book about it, because I had followed the company since the Into the Gloss days and had interviewed her several times, most notably for a big Vanity Fair profile right after they had become unicorns. It was really anointing her. And that was one of the last things I'd worked on before pandemic lockdown. So it was very clear in my mind. And she's a strange character. You know, there are so many female founders and women in business that I think really, I don't know, bend over backwards to try to be maybe like hyper articulate and really helpful towards press and kind of do anything you'd ask because they, you know, they need it. And they, you know, women are supposed to be friendly and accommodating, whether or not they want to be. And so there was something a little bit, I wouldn't say steely exactly, but something kind of unknowable about her, that she was never kind of giving me exactly what I wanted. And she was often, you know, she or her communications team were often saying no to me. And I love nothing more than people that play hard to get and give and reject me. So I was intrigued. And she did, you know, sign on to participate in the book. So, you know, she must have been motivated on some sense, but then at the same time, talking to her could just feel like, you know, talking to ChatGPT or I don't know, like Circles.
If she hadn't agreed to participate in the book, would it have been a different book? I feel like her participation didn't sort of ultimately move the needle very much.
It would have been a different book. I think that part of what people liked about the book was that she was participating, but that her participation was so deeply ambivalent, and it only sort of added to the questions and mystique around the brand, for at least for fans of it. I don't know. I mean, I was going to write the book either way, which is a good way to sort of make someone talk to you. But not always. There are plenty of people that said no to me.
Well, what did you learn from her in the course of writing the book? What did her participation like add to the book?
I think part of it was having interviewed her over the years. I had a lot of transcripts from, you know, quotes that were unused from interviewing her over about a decade. So I was able to sort of look back and see how her language had changed and the way that she spoke about things. And also during the course of writing, reporting the book, she stepped down as CEO.
Yeah, like we should mention this. Yeah. Like in, I feel like she's reached the apotheosis of the greatest thing that you can be in capitalism. Obviously, she's incredibly rich. You don't report this, but I'm assuming that at various waymarkers along, various rounds and stuff along the way, she's sold some stock to various investors.
It sounds, I mean, the estimates I have are she still owns around 20% at least.
But in any case, she's made a lot of money. She's probably made more money than she will ever be able to spend. She has a glamorous life in California.
Yeah, she's living a much more glamorous life than either one of us.
Probably spending a bunch of time in Paris because it's so glamorous.
She's kind of more of a Copenhagen person, but yeah.
But in any case, she has this glamorous life. She has lots of money. She has like one or two kids.
One
kid. And best of all, she has this glorious title, which is executive chair, which is...
What do you think that means?
So it is wonderful to be an executive chair, and it is the dumbest job in all of capitalism, because it is a contradiction in terms, right? The chair means you're the chair of the board, which means that you are ultimately the person to whom the CEO is accountable. Executive means that you are an executive who is actually doing work on a day-to-day basis for the organization. And as an executive, like all executives, you report to the CEO. So you're in this very awkward, weird situation of both reporting to the CEO and being the CEO's boss.
Yeah, and I would say that in her case, I view it as more of like an emeritus kind of position, where I'm sure she goes to, you know, board meetings and the like, of course, but I don't get the feeling from sources or just from her, you know, the way that she's sort of talking about her life, that she's very involved in the day to day any longer.
Yeah, I feel a lot of the girl bosses, when they get kicked out, they give themselves an executive chair position for a while, but eventually it does become a little bit silly. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised for the executive bit of that job title to quietly mm-hmm. sort of wither away, and she just becomes the board chair.
Well, she also quietly left, what's it called, Allbirds, the one board she was on last spring.
But it is a good job to have, because, you know, you can basically, especially if you're the founder, you can basically fire the CEO at any time and, you know, come back as a white knight should you feel so inclined. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, you know, when her kid's a bit older and she feels like she wants to get back into
that's doing a point I made in the book. She could do a Bob Iger. She could be, you know, Lorne Michaels coming back to SNL. She could be Steve Jobs.
Well, you know, what's his face
coming back?
Howard Schultz at Starbucks.
Exactly.
Coming back over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, if she wanted to, she could do that. I don't think she will, but, you know, time will tell.
Right. We have to take a break, but we'll be back after this. This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet. And it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I do want to talk about beauty as mm-hmm. an industry, because you talk a lot in this book about the beauty industry, and it's a weird word it's a weird descriptor for an industry. It's like, what are you selling? We're selling beauty. Oh, beauty is a thing that you can buy on a shelf in Sephora.
What would you rather call it? Personal care?
I am not the person to ask. I am not the target audience for this industry, but it is an interesting word that, like, people have sort of alighted upon, mm-hmm. especially for a company like Glossier, which was sort of founded on this idea that, you know, well, we're all beautiful already. So, you know, like, what am I buying in that case? You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the power and, you know, strange psychology, I guess, of the beauty industry, is that it can encapsulate deodorant. It could be, I guess, tampons. It can also be lipstick. It can also be $500 perfume. You know, you get into some, like, wellness products. Like, is it also, like, Goop has a sex aid division? Like, is it also that? Beauty can kind of be everything. And then you also have this play on words, sort of, where it's also about literal beauty and what constitutes beauty and what it means to want to make yourself look beautiful or better, or grooming, as they call it, for men.
And Emily Weiss famously went completely batshit when she got married. First time.
Yeah.
Tell me about that blog post, because I can't remember that bit of the book.
It was her, it was called Little Wedding Black Book. It was, I believe, 2016. She had a small, like, 3 dozen person wedding in the Bahamas. And she detailed the, you know, extreme treatments she had done, which range from, like, I don't know, massage, lasering, you know, lash extensions. It went on and on and on. At the end, she says, you know, at the end, I felt like an 8 out of 10. She's fond of like ranking and numbers. And it became this kind of viral thing where, you know, it's like the female version of the Roman Empire. People talk about it all the time.
How often do you think about that blog post, Marissa?
Oh, I mean, it's my professional life. I'm getting paid to think about it every day, but it definitely lived rent-free in my mind, as they say, for years. And, you know, many, many, many women felt the same way, because there's something really real about that, of kind of losing your mind over a wedding or something and like funneling it all into
how treatments. Self-aware was she when she wrote that?
Well, that's the part that is up for grabs. I would say medium, like medium rare, like medium to low self-awareness. Frankly, she was probably getting most of those treatments for free or nothing. And that's kind of her job as a beauty blogger. And so I think the post was probably more to get people their, you know, time to shine in exchange for giving her hair extensions or whatever. But it became this kind of fascination of like, wow, this gorgeous woman who is getting married put so much effort and really felt like a B+ or something at the end of the day. Like, you know, you could write a whole thesis about the state of self-esteem and feminism and late capitalism, all there. It's all there for you.
If feminism sort of succeeded in improving women's self-esteem, would that be devastating for the beauty industry?
That's a good question. Yes and no. I mean, beauty has always been there, right? Like, people wanted to, I don't know, rub berries on themselves. Like, beauty is a very human pursuit, right? Like, attraction and wanting to look good. And I don't necessarily think it's about degrading yourself. Also, like, toothpaste is technically a beauty product. Like, you know, I wouldn't really call that something that's purely for other people. But, you know, I think in the way that the beauty industry has been marketed in the last, you know, century, more is very much about, you know, some kind of top-down approach of like people deciding these are the colors and these are our models and this is what we're selling people. And, you know, even if now the message is sort of more contemporary and like, you don't need it, you know, and there's like a girl with freckles or a gap in her teeth to show us that you can be different and beautiful too. It's still like you should use these things so you look like less of a hag or whatever, you know?
It's hard for me as someone who's really not familiar with this industry to understand the degree to which Glossier was particularly revolutionary. There were a couple of things it did that were uncommon, mainly, most startlingly, the fact that it spent most of its first decade as a direct-to-consumer brand and wasn't available in Sephora. But also, there was always this idea, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, because I don't really know if this is true, but there was this idea that because it grew out of a blog and because there was a community there, that its products and its whole sort of gestalt was slightly more crowdsourced, and instead of being like the brand that tells you what to wear, it was like, we're going to get together and build something that we want.
Yeah, you're correct in that. I think that that was maybe a little oversold. I think that they had very, really savvy product developers who also knew the market and thought, we need to do a great cleanser, a really good sunscreen, like your lips, but better, sort of, you know, lip tint or something. But they definitely had this free sort of audience and this very, you know, verbose community of commenters who had a lot to say about what their ideal cleanser was, or, you know, whether or not they would ever use an eye cream or something like that. So that was definitely part of it. And it worked. People bought it. People, you know, were very excited about it. I think the thing to understand about it maybe is that in some ways, it had less to do with, you know, L'Oreal or any typical beauty brand than it had to do with something like Supreme, like these, you know, streetwear brands, where when Glossier came out, they only had 4 products and they were all kind of random. Like, one was a mist, One was a balm. I remember even seeing it and thinking, you know, where is like the 12 like nail polishes or something like that. And so they really sort of started this thing where you were hungry for what the next thing that they would come out with that could delight you. And Emily Weiss always said that she wanted to be a beauty brand that people wanted to wear a sweatshirt of. And now the merch section in their stores are as big as the, you know, actual beauty products.
The Supreme business model, of course, is all based on artificial scarcity. And, you know, we're only going to make so many of these and then it's going to be sold out. And very much based on the idea of being able to flip the items on the secondary market and make a hypothetical or actual profit on what you buy at the store.
Glossier does that to a certain extent, too.
Glossier does that to a much, I mean, but the core, smaller, the core of what mm-hmm. they do is you buy a thing and then you put it on your face and then it's gone and then it's
and then consumed, you buy more of it.
Mm-hmm. And then you buy more of it. But they did do something which has become a much bigger deal in retail over the past, I'm going to say 10 years. And I think they were quite early to this, which is that when they moved into physical retail, the physical real world manifestation of artificial scarcity was always the line outside the Supreme store.
Mm-hmm.
And Supreme was famous for, you know, it would have an enormous store and it would allow two people in it just to make sure there was always a line outside, because that line itself was the best ad for the store they could possibly do. And Glossier totally picked up on that and created a long line outside the store. That was their thing. I live very close by to their place on Lafayette Street. And there was
there was one on Black Friday. I saw it.
Constantly a line outside that bloody store.
And I live not far from that one too.
And
yeah.
I'm sure there were a million ways in which if they, you know, didn't want to force people to line up, they could just allow them into the store. But no, the line serves a very interesting purpose. And I feel they were like, it started in Japan and then it kind of made its way over to New York. And now you see it all over the place in New York.
Yeah, I think so. I remember going to Japan in like the year 2000, and there were lines for like a bathing ape and those kinds of stores. And I had never really seen a line out of the store in the way. And then, you know, Supreme and the streetwear brands, and Glossier was definitely one of the first sort of like female targeted brands that had that same kind of line culture. And I remember going to their original flagship in the middle of the summer, and it was a weekend and there was a huge line, and they had the salespeople who weirdly they called editors. That's a whole other thing.
Bloggers. That's bloggers and that's editors.
Well, they were called offline editors, I believe. it's you know. Anyway, they came out and they were spritzing people with rose-scented mists and offering up sunscreen to make your line waiting a little more, I don't know, bearable in the heat.
But the line is this way that even if you never stand in line and you never go into the store, you pass the line and you think, well,
they must be doing well.
All of these people are willing to stand in line, then obviously this is something worth standing in line for. And it's a great, it's an amazing thing, to the point at which I now see lines outside, you know, super high-end luxury brands in mm-hmm. Soho, outside, you know, Vuitton or Hermes or someone like that.
And I'm mm-hmm.
like, what? Seriously, like, that's not customer service.
But you also see it in front of, like, Majori, like a D2C jewelry line, too. It's everyone has a line these days. I think part of it for Glossier, at least there was one tiny element that made sense, and that being a D2C brand for beauty is like asking a lot of people. Like, it's hard to buy a, you know, like a concealer or a lipstick, or even know if you want to spend $60 on a perfume if you have no way of trying it. Even if you have like a really generous return policy, that's still a lot, particularly when so many of your fans are young. So I think a lot of them, when they were able to come to a city that had a flagship or a pop-up, wanted to literally be able to touch and try the products. Plus, they had these very high design stores that were meant for like maximum Instagram and TikTok engagement. So you had these, you know, human size versions of their products to pose with and all of that.
Yeah, the selfie optimized store, I feel, is like a trend which cannot
really
cannot die soon enough.
It's really intense. Yeah, it's like the color factory version of retail. It's, you know, it's the fake Instagram museum or whatever they are.
Quick break and we'll be straight back.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
There was this abortive attempt to create like a sub-brand, which was more sort of colorful and more, we're going to make something that you guys are going to love. Mm-hmm. And that
you're talking about Glossier Play.
Uh-huh. Glossier Play. There you go. You see, yeah. The reason it failed was obviously because it didn't sound French.
Well, what if I told you it's spelled P-L-E with an accent? Aigu.
Plié. There you go.
Play. No, it was spelled like play. It was, you know, on the mood board were the sort of things that you might imagine, like Studio 54, glitter, those kinds of things. And instead of making it, I don't know, like a holiday collection of kind of going out makeup or just some new products, they decided to experiment with making a whole sub-brand. I think part of that is just, I don't know, maybe the sort of like, what are we going to do with all this money? Like, how are we scaling? And maybe we're this brand that's going to have all of these sub-brands. I say maybe because it was also half-baked. I mean, they also threw a lot of money at making an app that, you know, never saw the light of day and never even seemed to really have a name. I interviewed dozens of people about it and no one could really tell me what it was going to do or the name of it. So I think part of it was just, yeah, like, how are we going to scale? How do we prove that we're worth all of this money? Like,
I feel like it's not rocket science. Like, it's been done a bunch of times and they're actually doing it now under the new CEO. Like, when I was, when I first moved to New York in the 90s, there was a nearby store in the East Village called Kiehl's.
And, heard of them?
And we all love Kiehl's, and it was this great little sort of like East Village secret. And
yeah, then that's the original one, and then on Third Avenue.
And then they got bought by, was it L'Oreal?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was L'Oreal. Yeah. And then suddenly, like, and then there was this sort of immediate wake in the East Village. We're all like, well, that's the end of Kiehl's because they've been bought by some mega.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you and should add that like every beauty line is owned by one of, I think, about five conglomerates. I mean, it's pretty wild, which is also like, you know, are we just looking at the clock until Glossier is acquired by one of them?
Emily Weiss owns, what did you say, about 20% of the company. It's not really up to her. She has a bunch of VCs on her cap table, right?
Yeah, that's
they're going to want an exit. It's 10 years. It's getting on for 10 years old. That's about the time that VCs want their exit.
I think probably pre-pandemic, her idea was to IPO, which who knows if that would have ever happened. None of the beauty IPOs that have happened have done remotely well lately. So now I think, I think that's why they're in Sephora, for example, and trying to, you know, look as good as possible. I had a big story that they, you know, definitely pitched on themselves for Women's Wear Daily. Yeah, I think they're trying to look as good as possible for that. But also, you know, it's a few years off. Like, beauty companies were selling for wild amounts of money in maybe like 2018 or 5 years ago. And it's not 2018 anymore, baby.
As you say, there are five big beauty companies and they own everything. A couple of them are in serious financial straits.
Yeah.
Estee Lauder, I think, being the prime, or Revlon being the prime example.
Revlon, yeah. I would think Lauder would be the one that would most make sense with Glossier. But again, I don't know that they're in a place to do it.
So yeah, they're not doing that well. They don't have a lot of money to throw around for acquisitions. But there is something timeless about them, you know? Even if Revlon were to file for bankruptcy, which is not out of the, you know, it's not unthinkable by any means, the brand would stay strong, the bondholders would take over the equity, and the company would just continue as this great juggernaut that it is, because it just has so much brain space in the public imagination.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the name of their like most famous long-standing product?
No. but
Cherries in the Snow.
It's
a Revlon lipstick that's been around since, I don't know, like the 30s or something, 50s.
But then I compare that to, you know, whatever brand was dreamt up 5 minutes ago by Kylie Jenner or Rihanna or someone like that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like those can grow incredibly fast and they can have their 15 minutes of fame. But it's not clear how they then sort of go through that awkward adolescent phase and become the eternal brand, which is where the real money is.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's such a crowded market. In the time since Glossier launched, it's seemingly every star has their own beauty brand. Adele just filed for, I think, you know, some kind of trademark for a beauty brand forthcoming. I think maybe eyeliner or something. And you know, when Brad Pitt has a skincare line, truly everyone has one. And so, yeah, there's a lot of competition there. I think Glossier is at the like awkward phase, the awkward adolescence. And I guess it just remains to be seen if they're going to come out on the other side or what that's going to look like. They seem to be doing okay, but again, we're, you know,
that they're a private company.
Yeah, we don't know.
Release their financials.
Exactly.
And, you know, if one day they come out and announce, you know what, this isn't working and we're just like closing down, like no one would be that surprised.
Yeah.
But for the time being.
What time being? Before they become acquired
Become acquired or go bankrupt. Yeah, they are out there.
Before the inevitable.
What proportion of your personal beauty budget gets spent on Glossier products?
Oh, gosh. I mean, because it's been so much of my professional life, it's hard for me to look at some of them and not just be reminded of my job. I tend to go more hard in like the European pharmacy duty-free situation, like killing time at, you know, Heathrow or something like that.
So Glossier hasn't made it to Heathrow duty-free yet?
Not yet.
That's the brass ring right there. If you're sold at Heathrow, you're duty-free.
Yeah. I mean, they might. I don't. Are there? I mean, they were launching in this. Sephora was coming to the UK and they're there. Anyway, who knows? But when they get to Heathrow duty-free, that's where I'm like supermarket sweeping my beauty things, all that good European sunscreen and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not wearing any makeup right now. I'm not a big, in some ways, I'm a weird person to be writing about this because I own plenty of makeup, but I don't wear a lot of it. I have a skincare routine, but it's pretty simple. But the whole world fascinates me. I guess I'm the equivalent of like Tony Goodman, the like Vogue fashion editor who famously just wears like a black turtleneck and white jeans every day.
Marissa Meltzer, thanks so much for coming on the show. I have learned a ton, both from your book and from this here conversation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Many thanks to Jared Downing for producing. And we will be back on Saturday with a regular Slate Money.